I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's start today with what else? Politics. Just a week before the November 2nd midterms. How can that be? Most of the attention has been on the congressional races and whether Republicans will take full control of Congress. But 37 states are also electing governors next Tuesday. And it's governors who really have to deal with the economy on a day-to-day basis and will also be in charge when congressional districts are redrawn based on the 2010 census. The Washington Post lists five governors' races to watch: California, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Florida, where Republican Rick Scott, a political newcomer and former healthcare group CEO, and Democrat Alex Sink, Florida's chief financial officer, meet for their final debate tonight. So let's check in on Florida. Mark Caputo covers politics for the Miami Herald. Mark, characterize this race between Scott and Sink right now.
I'm going to go cliche. I'm saying it's too close to call.
Okay. But is that a surprise that it's even close?
It is, because this is a year where things seem to be moving so Republican. But in this race, Rick Scott versus Alex Sink, we have a very, very close race. Too close to call. Our poll showed about 3 percentage points, but there's a good 8 days of campaigning and voting left to do because we have early voting. That it's really up in the air.
Okay, well, tell us about the candidates. You mentioned Republican Rick Scott. He was a political outsider, and some said he brought a lot of baggage when he came to the race. Tell us more.
He limped out of the Republican primary. Attorney General Bill McCollum, a former congressman, manager of the House impeachment of Bill Clinton, he had really gone after Rick Scott for having headed the Columbia HCA hospital chain in the 1990s, which ultimately got whacked with a $1.7 billion Medicare fraud fine. In a state with a lot of elderly voters, such as Florida, Medicare fraud doesn't play well in election season. And if you're the opponent of the person with this is their political baggage, as you say, you can certainly make this a big issue. Bill McCollum didn't have as much success. Alex Sink, now a former banker, is now making much ado about this problem in Rick Scott's past.
Well, tell us, though, I mean, as you say, Rick Scott won the Republican primary. So what's he got going for him?
He has a lot of money. He's independently wealthy. He spent about $55 million, almost all of it his own money, in the primary. And in addition to that, there is a real thirst for this election season for something new. And he made his campaign rather simple. This campaign is about jobs. I grew jobs in the private sector. Elect me. I'll fix the economy.
All right. Well, tell us about the Democrat, Alex Sink, as we said, the state's chief financial officer. And Rick Scott has been trying to tie her to President Obama and some of the problems with the economy. And at one point, they had a terrific exchange in a debate when he accused her of doing Obama math. And she said, I don't know what Obama math is. I was a 4.0 math major at Wake Forest University. What else is Alex Sink?
Well, Alex Sink is a former banker. She was president of Nations Bank, Florida. She then entered politics for the first time in 2006 and won the state's chief financial officer position. That seemed like a great background in 2006, banker, chief financial officer. But boy, people really don't like bankers now. And if you got the word financial in your title and finances of the state are so bad, then it's not going to be much of a strength for you. And that's kind of the challenge she faces. Also, being a banker, she's kind of intrinsically cautious. And it makes the race a little interesting because you have Rick Scott, who's very aggressive, kind of a gambler, and you got this banker who's very cautious. In the meantime, you have Obama, not popular in the state. Florida has just seen a record job loss, record foreclosures, record unemployment. And Sink is essentially not running as a Democrat. When Obama was in town last at a fundraiser in Miami, she made sure to be in another city entirely.
Well, and yet, as you said, this race is tight. So what is it that voters are liking about Alex Sink?
Because she's running as a nonpartisan candidate, so to speak, she's attracting independents. And independents, in the end, swing the election one way or the other. So the independents are a key demographic, and she appeals to them. Also, some of them are less likely to vote the party line, and a lot of the negatives, the attacks on Rick Scott, have stuck. So that makes her rather popular. Last thing, Florida's a purple state, neither red nor blue, and it has a tendency to elect different personalities or be a bit fickle. So in 2006, when Republicans got slaughtered nationwide, we elected a Republican at the time, Charlie Crist. Well, that's true. He was at the time. He's now left the Republican Party. So now you could see, in a Republican wave year, a Democrat getting elected. It's possible, and there's a lot nationally riding on this, because if there's a Democrat in office, she can reject a congressional redistricting plan that creates too many Republican seats in Florida. So it's important nationwide.
And hasn't she also done things like try to get claims from a BP spill pushed through? I mean, she's done things that people have applauded.
She was a real critical voice in the state cabinet against BP early on. And she made a lot of tours to Florida's Panhandle, which is where some of the oil was washing up on beaches. And she did herself quite a bit of PR good there. Will it be enough? Well, obviously, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, we've dropped in on some of the debates and the back-and-forth accusations in this race. It gets into very detailed legalese because, as we said, both have been in the business world and faced questions about practices. Rick Scott may be more than Alex Sink. But it seems as if that's difficult to follow. What do you think this race is going to turn on?
Oh, it's simple. It's the economy, stupid, as was said long ago. It's going to come down to jobs, jobs, jobs. And in the end, the candidate who's able to communicate that message the best is probably going to win. And we have seen, as of late, Rick Scott has done a better job making himself the jobs candidate. And as a result, he slightly leads in the polls.
Mark Caputo covers politics for the Miami Herald. Mark, thanks.
Thank you.
When you buy a home, the paperwork is overwhelming, and then often at the very last minute before closing, you learn you have to buy title insurance. Now, it varies depending on the state and the value of the home, but it can be thousands of dollars. What you say? It feels like a scam, a last-minute gotcha. But title insurance lubricates the entire real estate industry. And as we're about to hear, it's at the center of the next real estate crisis. So brace yourself, because today, to help us understand what's being called this brewing storm, we're joined by Kathleen Howley. She covers real estate for Bloomberg News. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us more. What is title insurance?
It's something like over $10 billion a year industry. And what they do is the title insurance company will search the title and make sure it's clear. And then they will do that before insuring a property.
So they make sure that it's free and clear to be sold, that nobody else is holding a title on it.
Exactly,
anyway, right?
Yes. And when they do that search, they have to go back to, until the time we took the land from the Native Americans, because there could be competing claims on a property. I mean, just to give you an example, my great-grandmother died in 1920 and left five somewhat young children, and the eldest took a property that she had, a cottage outside of the city, and sold it without getting the signatures of his younger brothers and sisters. I mean, he saw himself at that point as the head of the family. Well, that property since has been sold and resold, and my mother is an heir to my grandmother, one of the people who did not sign to agree to this property being transferred, I suppose, could go and knock at the door of this house and say,
I didn't agree.
That's right.
Wow. Well, enough of your family history. I hope that works itself out.
Oh, no. Let sleeping dogs lie.
Okay. So that's a perfect example. So the title company has done this search. They've assured themselves that nobody else owns title to this home, that it's free and clear. And so they now feel free to insure you in the future, so that if somebody comes along, like Kathleen's mother, and says she has a right to the house, they'll say, no, we did the title search. They'll back you up.
They'll back you up. They'll go to court. They'll provide lawyers. And if you lose, they will indemnify you for the property. Although, of course, if you buy a house and spend $100,000 fixing it up, that's not covered by the title insurance policy, but you'll get back a lot of what you sunk into a home. But it's important to know that when you buy a house, you have to get title insurance for the lender. You pay for it, but you're insuring the mortgage company. And most people don't realize that they should also get title insurance for themselves. A lot of people don't realize they're just buying the policy for the mortgage company.
Yeah, tell us about that. In other words, it's the mortgage company that will be repaid if, in fact, it turns out that somebody else lays claim to the home, not you, the owner?
That's right. That's why you need an owner's policy. You don't know who could pop up and lay a claim against your property, particularly with what's happening in the mortgage market and with foreclosures. People who buy foreclosed property may not realize that with all of the shoddy paperwork that's been done and the packaging and repackaging of loans and the securitization boom, that there may not be proper paperwork. And when the foreclosure is done, it possibly could be challenged by the people who lost their home. And now you have somebody with a competing claim on your property.
But I guess what I'm missing here is, why didn't that turn up in a title search? Didn't they have to do the title search to buy the foreclosed home?
Title companies have been giving titles to foreclosed properties, taking on a greater risk than they would for a property that wasn't in foreclosure. If properties can't get title insurance, then the whole real estate machine grinds to a halt. And that's why it's seen as a critical issue to get the real estate market back to a place where, in fact, people can get title insurance, if only for the mortgage company, and these deals can go through.
So to underscore, you're saying the title insurance companies, like everyone else in the housing scandal, it sounds like, took risks, gave out title insurance when in some cases they shouldn't have. But that's what the title insurance is for. Again, if you buy the homeowner version, if someone pops up who makes a legitimate claim that the title insurance search missed, that title insurance will cover you. But what are your other concerns?
It is possible that somebody could pop up and say, I have a claim against this property. And it very well could be that it wasn't found in the title search. But then when you go to sell it, the next title insurance company finds something that the first one didn't, something they overlooked. And now you can't get title insurance for this property, so you can't sell it.
Well, this brings us to the concerns that there is this storm brewing on the horizon, because as we know, there was a ban on foreclosures because it was discovered that the paperwork was so sloppy. Robo-signers were signing off on thousands of documents they couldn't possibly have looked at. But, you know, Kathleen, most analysts we've heard have said most of those homeowners, in fact, had defaulted on their mortgage, that when the dust settles, in fact, we just saw several companies start back up doing the foreclosures because they feel that the preponderance of evidence is that the homeowners that are being foreclosed on deserve to be foreclosed on.
Yes, they haven't paid their mortgages, so obviously, you know, they're defaulted on their mortgage. But in fact, there is a proper procedure that has to be followed or the foreclosure is not valid. If the foreclosure isn't done correctly, then the mortgage holder has no right to kick anybody out of a home. We've heard a lot about robo-signing and, in fact, companies that may have fraudulently signed affidavits used in foreclosure proceedings. But really, that's the tip of the iceberg, because what happened during the securitization boom that we saw over $6 trillion of mortgages that were bought and sold and packaged into bonds and then chopped up and resold. A lot of times that paperwork wasn't done correctly. There was sloppy underwriting, which means when you're being underwritten, they're checking on whether, in fact, you do make as much money as you say you make. There were a lot of very loose lending standards. Another thing to remember is that in real estate, you can't give somebody a copy of a mortgage or a promissory note. Just like you couldn't hand somebody, or you couldn't bring a copy of a dollar bill down to the bank and have them honor it, you have to have the original. So when these loans were packaged, a lot of times the paperwork was either sent to a document custodian in Iowa and then promptly lost, or in some cases they were shredded because people felt at the time that they were electronically registering these documents and that would be fine. There really wasn't much consideration given to, well, gee, what if we have the largest foreclosure crisis since the Great Depression? What will we do then?
That's Kathleen Howley. She covers real estate for Bloomberg News. As we're about to hear, several banks are starting up their foreclosure procedures again today after a brief pause because of concerns about the cases, some of the current concerns we just heard about. And as we'll hear, Kathleen still has those concerns. We're talking about title insurance and how it fits into the whole housing crisis. We'll have more with Kathleen Howley after a quick break. Also later today, Here Now media analyst John Carroll calls it anti-social media, the trend of consumers using Facebook and Twitter to get companies to do about faces. The Gap comes to mind. That's later, back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're learning today about title insurance. It's the last phase of a home sale, an insurance policy buyers have to take out to protect the lender in case a previous owner comes out of the woodwork and lays claim to a house. But our guest, Bloomberg News real estate reporter Kathleen Howley, says buyers should purchase a title insurance policy for themselves as well, especially as so many foreclosures are being challenged. And Kathleen, despite those challenges, two big banks, GMAC and Bank of America, are restarting their foreclosure cases today after a pause. Your thoughts?
What's amazing is that these cases have been pursued in such a shoddy, sloppy way that never would be stood for in any other type of legal case. The judges would throw them all out of court. But for some reason, in these foreclosure cases, the courts are just so overwhelmed that they're just processing them like robotically.
Is the reason that these banks want to get this debt off their books?
Exactly. But what surprises me is that the attorneys who have been submitting fraudulent affidavits and submitting foreclosure cases without having the promissory note or the original mortgage There is a way around that. You can submit an affidavit, hopefully not fraudulent, saying, we've searched for this note, we cannot find it, but here's other proof that, in fact, we do have rights to this. They're not doing that. They're just submitting cases that are just missing these important documents, and it's going right through the court system. But lawyers who defend people who are fighting a foreclosure suit are saying that this is rampant in the courts right now. One attorney I've spoken to did a study of about 200 foreclosure cases in Florida, and he said that in three-fourths of the cases, there were major mistakes that really should have kept these cases from ever going forward.
Kept the foreclosures from going forward.
Exactly. In Western Massachusetts, there's a family living in a Cape Cod-style home that they were thrown out of a couple of years ago. They moved back in last year after a judge said that the foreclosure was done in the wrong way, and they should never have been kicked out of the house. That case is, in fact, the Ibanez case is up for review by Massachusetts' highest court. But in the land court, a lower court, the judge really took the mortgage companies to task for not having the correct paperwork and throwing these people out of a house when they had no right to do so.
Well, and title insurance companies are now worried that they're going to have to pay out big time if these foreclosed homeowners start winning their homes back. And some of the companies are now asking banks and lenders to provide warranties. For example, Fidelity National Financial, that's America's largest title insurer, announced last week they're now requiring banks and lenders to vouch for the accuracy of their mortgage documents before Fidelity will sell title insurance on a foreclosed home.
In fact, they could pursue the banks anyways, but they would have to launch a legal suit. What they're doing is just right up front saying it's going to be your fault if there's a mistake. And what's interesting is that this news is presented as, oh, let's all have a big sigh of relief because now, you know, the foreclosures can continue to be sold and the whole real estate machine can keep on working. When in fact, yes, it protects the title companies, but if you're somebody who's bought a foreclosed home, it doesn't do much for you if the foreclosure was done sloppily and you end up losing the right to be in that home. So it's not that great news for consumers. And in fact, someone could say, well, I'm not going to buy a foreclosed property. It's too risky, especially given this news. What about 10 years down the road and you buy a house and you don't realize that, in fact, this had been a foreclosure. It was sold to somebody who then sold it to somebody and then you came along and you don't know it's a foreclosure and the foreclosure was done in a very sloppy manner.
It sounds like buyer beware.
Yeah. A big part of this problem is that the securitization boom resulted in real estate law really being pushed to the limit, inventing things like the Mortgage Electronic Registration Service. You'll hear a lot about this so-called MERS. Registering documents electronically when, in fact, the old way was you went down to the local registry and paid them some sum of money, $40, $50, $60. They skipped that, and they all registered their documents electronically. Well, we don't know if that's going to stand up in court. There have been some cases that have allowed it and some cases that haven't, and the final test hasn't been done as to whether this is a legal way to transfer property. Right now, about half of all mortgages in the U.S. are registered on MERS. Just to show you the scope of this problem. And real estate is really an archaic industry. You know, when you look at deeds, it will say something like the land bounded by Farmer Brown's barn on the east mm-hmm. and Farmer Jones's stone wall on the west. When I went to buy my house 4 years ago, it's a fixer-upper, I was in the registry where we had all the lawyers and we were about to sign all the documents, and I read the deed, and it literally said, on the land formerly known as the Poor Farm. So this is how, in this day and age when everybody has a cell phone that has a GPS system on it, we are transferring real estate in this very archaic way. But that is the law as it stands now. We haven't seen what will happen and how the courts will rule on these new systems that they invented, blank assignments, you know, writing on a promissory note. Whoever is holding this paper is now the legal owner. I mean, that hasn't been tested in court.
Well, so meantime, what do you recommend people do?
Today or 10 years ago or 10 years from now, you should always get an owner's policy for title insurance. Not just the policy for the mortgage company, but get your own policy.
And by the way, we mentioned that this happens sort of at the last minute. It takes a lot of people by surprise. So they just run with whatever they're told to do. But can you shop around for title companies?
Yes. There are sites where you can shop around, depending on varying laws from state to state, but it's something that everyone who's buying a home should look into, because in many cases it's possible to save hundreds of dollars by doing a little research. And secondly, I mean, if there is a problem with a loan going into default, most people don't contest that at all. Most people don't think to get a lawyer. In fact, nowadays, most lawyers don't really know much about this part of real estate law and fighting foreclosures. And it's important to get a lawyer and use a lawyer who really has detailed knowledge of this.
How long do you expect this sort of concern about who actually owns homes and if foreclosures are legitimate and, if, you know, how long do you think this is going to go on?
That's hard to say, but I know we haven't even seen some phases of it. For example, now the investors in mortgage-backed securities are saying that the lenders have to buy back these loans. The underwriting was faulty. They misrepresented the quality of the mortgages. And I think we'll see many other phases after this. In particular, everybody now is going to know to fight their foreclosures. We've seen the courts already overwhelmed with foreclosures. This is going to slow down the process even more.
That's Kathleen Howley. She covers real estate for Bloomberg News. Kathleen, thank you.
You're welcome.
And this is all reminding me that tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll be speaking with a disaster preparedness expert. That's tomorrow. Latest news is next, Here and Now. Japan is well known for having a huge number of people over 100 years old, but a Japanese government report this fall found that all is not as it seems, that more than 200,000 Japanese listed as centenarians can't be located, and that many of them may have died decades ago while their relatives continue to claim their pensions. The BBC's Roland Burke reports from Tokyo.
It is an ordinary Tokyo street, just a few old houses packed in together quite tightly. But until recently, this place had a claim to fame. It was thought to be the home of Tokyo's oldest man, Sōgen Katō. The official record showed he was 111. But he didn't play the part of a local celebrity very well. In fact, no one round here could remember seeing him for years. Not surprising, because when local officials became suspicious and the police went into the home he shared with his children and grandchildren, they found Mr. Katō's mummified body. In the state of it, he'd probably been dead for 30 years.
I live on the other side of the river. I pass by their house every single day. The windows were always shut, whether it was hot or cold outside. He told it was suspicious.
Akira Naimoto was also concerned. He's from the local authority's elderly care team.
He was the oldest man in Tokyo. He could soon have become the oldest man in Japan. It would have been a huge problem if we hadn't seen him, so we were worried. When we found out he was actually dead, it was a bit of a relief. I thought I've solved that problem before I retired.
But what had happened in this quiet corner of northern Tokyo, where tranquil piped music plays in the streets, had shocked all of Japan, especially when Mr. Katō's relatives were alleged to have still been claiming his pension. A search through the records found more than 200,000 other would-be centenarians unaccounted for. Akira Naimoto led the operation in his area.
We asked the volunteers to go to each home to visit them. Obviously, it would be off-putting if we started asking, "Are you still alive?" So we asked the volunteers to take brochures offering to introduce the elderly to new service introduced by the authority. Japanese society is changing. People live more in cities and family relations are broken down. No one ever thought people would hide someone being dead.
Japan's problem is that, quite simply, the country is aging very fast. We've come to the place that is officially Japan's oldest village, Nanmoku, a few hours outside Tokyo. Here, more than 56% of people are over the age of 65. The old must look after the old. Now, Saito-san is a very sprightly 75. So, Saito-san, you brought us to one end of the village. All the shops here are shuttered and many of the houses have got their curtains drawn as well. It's really quiet too. Is anybody still living here or is this entirely abandoned?
An old couple lived there. Nobody else lived here except them. They used to have a kimono shop.
And why is it empty?
People are leaving gradually. You can't make a living here. The kids leave to live in the cities.
So this is what you do to check up on people, just knock on their door and say hi. Sato-san, you're a pillar of the local community, looking out for people who are older than you are.
Sometimes we notice poles piling up. When we open up the door, we find someone has been dead for a few days.
But you notice fairly quickly. It's not like that in the city sometimes, is it?
Compared to cities, we don't have many cases like that. It's really rare.
In Nanmoku, the dead are found pretty quickly. But 75-year-old Saito-san worries about what will happen when even the relative youngsters like him grow more infirm. Then these villages will be like Japan's cities, where the deaths of some of the very old are going unnoticed or even being hidden.
The BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. Well, remember the noisy chip bag or the ill-fated Gap logo? They're part of a trend coming up here and now. You'd think a company would be thrilled to have 800,000 Facebook followers, and they are, until all 800,000 turn on them. That's what happened to Gap recently when the company tried to change its iconic navy blue box logo to kind of a denim thing. Gap fans went wild on the company's Facebook page. Thousands of comments like, "The brand image is very downmarket. Hate the new logo. Looks cheap, like Walmart. I'm done shopping at the Gap since its logo no longer reflects what I want from a store." Our first reaction was, really? Gap has Facebook fans? But Gap's reaction was to switch back to the old logo. Let's take a look at how social media is influencing the way companies do business with Here and Now media analyst and Boston University communication professor John Carroll. Now, John, you have a name for this trend.
Yeah, this is sort of a trend toward anti-social media, which is a lot of people rising up against what companies are doing. They're rising up on the internet, and they get this sort of critical mass going, sometimes to a greater, sometimes to a lesser degree. But what happens is the marketers feel like they have to respond. So what you've got is much more of a two-way process at this point, as opposed to the old one-way advertising process.
Right, and a lot of people saw the Gap story, but if they didn't, we'll have the two logos side by side at Here and Now. org. But, you know, here you are saying that the Gap felt it had to respond. But then you have BNet. This is an online news source. They write, "Nobody really cares about logos. Ad Age did research and found only 17% out of 1,000 consumers were even aware anything had changed. 29% said logo influenced their decision, but 43% said it didn't, and 28%, you know, said, I don't really know what I think about that." So, you know, BNet and others are saying, wait a second, the Gap should not have reacted to this.
Well, nobody cares about logos until they care about logos. So you had the situation with Tropicana orange juice, for instance, where they changed their graphics. They used to have the orange with the straw stuck in it. They changed their graphics. There was an outpouring of protest. They lost 20% of sales. And then they finally capitulated and went back to the old one. So there are situations where it can have damaging effects on your sales. In the situation the Gap is in, I think that the logo is the least of their problems. I mean, their sales are down because their merchandise mix is wrong, they're flat, and they don't have a creative approach to the marketplace.
Well, this is what BNet said. They said you should go forth and use Facebook and tweet the heck out of new styles. Win over that 29% who say, I don't even know what you're talking about with the logo.
That's the classic sort of textbook response here is go engage with these customers who have a problem with you. So you can't ignore them. You can't outshout them. What you have to do is go engage with them and try to enlist them and bring them over to your side. So try to get them to help you solve whatever problem you have. So that's a sort of a two-edged sword, too, because the Gap immediately, when the protest came up, said, okay, well, why don't you help us do a logo? And the design community was up in arms saying, what, are you looking for free work here? Yeah. So there are downsides to that, too. But basically, you can't ignore the customer base. Once they start circulating their message on the internet, you know, you've got to engage in it. Otherwise, your brand gets hijacked by the people who are out there on social media.
Well, and just a real quick question, though. How is this different from when Coke, you know, we always go back to Coke, when they decided to change their look and people were up in arms? That was before Facebook, before Twitter, and Coke had to respond to fans. I mean, Isn't this just exponentially more, but the same as it's always been?
It's the same process, but it's on steroids. It's speeded up so much. I mean, go back to the 70s. I mean, think about the grape boycott back in the 70s. That extended over a course of 20 years. A group like Neighbor to Neighbor trying to boycott Salvadoran coffee. I mean, they were going church basement to church basement, supermarket to supermarket. I mean, what you had was a real difficulty in mobilizing, and it was real painstaking, time-consuming work. Now what you have is a vehicle whereby you can form a group with critical mass in the course of days as opposed to years.
I'm thinking of Sunchips. They were trying to make a greener bag, but it turned out to be really crinkly and loud. Everybody went online with the sound of the bag. And, you know, they finally had to change it. And people were saying, I can't go to a movie with green chips.
Right. There were Facebook groups saying, I'm sorry, I can't hear you over the sound of the Sun Chips bag. There was an Air Force pilot who on his blog said, this is louder than the cockpit of my jet. And then he went and measured the decibels of a Sun Chips bag, which was 95 decibels.
But see, in this case, it's negative, you might say. They're only talking about the bag. I'm seeing Sun Chips.
Right. Right. I mean, this is one of those ones where, any publicity is good publicity in a way. But Sunchips had built its reputation on being a green company. So what they don't want to do is backslide. So they're looking for some kind of biodegradable material that doesn't make so much noise so they can get back to an eco-friendly bag, because that's a big part of their identity.
Yeah. And we remember, too, Canadian musician David Carroll spent a year trying to get United Airlines to pay for a guitar they broke. And when they didn't, he launched this YouTube video. We just love this. United breaks guitars.
Some big help you are. You broke it, you should fix it. Liable, just admit it. I should have flown with someone else or gone by car. 'Cause United breaks guitars.
Yeah, you know, more than 9 million people have seen that video. United tried to pay for the guitar, too late. But they promised to change the way they do business. And we understand from recent books that we've covered, like Your Call Is Not That Important to Us, that companies understand that they have to go to social media or die. I guess you're saying, John Carroll, make sure you know what to do when it turns into anti-social media.
Right, and also this monitoring has sort of two sides to it. One is they all have now social media relationship managers, and they monitor Twitter and they monitor Facebook. And what happens is all of a sudden they start contacting you. After you tweet, I've been waiting for the Comcast guy forever to show up, all of a sudden Comcast contacts you. And on the one hand, that's good customer service. On the other hand, it's a little creepy stalky too. And so some people have that sort of reaction. Don't be paying attention to me. I was just telling my friends. I wasn't telling you. So how you manage it is a big part of how successful it is. But I think the idea of engagement is something that marketers increasingly are coming to see can be a positive if you do it the right way.
I guess that's also a warning to people, the consumers who engage in social media. You're being watched.
Exactly. And you think you're just talking to your friends, and the company's watching you. So that can be good. That can be bad, depending on how the company reacts.
John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst and Boston University College of Communication professor. You can follow his blog, Campaign Outsider, at our website, hereandnow.org, where we'll also have some of the videos we mentioned. John, thanks.
Thanks, Robin.
It hasn't been published yet, and it's an Amazon bestseller, even though the author's been dead for over 100 years, a report that isn't greatly exaggerated. It's the autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, which comes out November 15th, all 736 pages of it. Finally, the first installment in the story of the life of the man who brought us classics like The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. In Volume 1, Twain addresses topics big, the U.S. military action in the Philippines, and small, like the food at his uncle's farm.
The way that things were cooked was perhaps the main splendor, particularly a certain few of the dishes. For instance, the cornbread, the hot biscuits and wheat bread, and the fried chicken. These things have never been properly cooked in the North. In fact, no one there is able to learn the art, so far as my experience goes. The North thinks it knows how to make cornbread, but that is gross superstition. Perhaps no bread in the world is quite as good as Southern cornbread, and perhaps no bread in the world is quite so bad as the Northern imitation of it. The North seldom tries to fry chicken, and this is well. The art cannot be learned north of the Mason-Dixon, nor anywhere in Europe.
That's Here and Now literary critic Steve Allman reading from the autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, and he joins us in the studio with more. So, Steve, is it worth all the hype?
Oh, yeah. Totally worth the hype. Worth the hype, worth the wait, unbelievable.
And worth the wait, W-E-I-G-H-T?
Yes, oh. It is a heavy book, and it's the first of, I mean, this is a 500,000 words we're talking about. Twain tried to start his autobiography literally dozens of times, and finally struck gold with this formula that is basically he just dictated for the last few years of his life, and he had a stenographer who was a good audience, was always important to Twain, and she just took down every word. So it's a really rambling, fascinating book that touches on everything that he was as a writer, commentator, sort of moral voice in the culture.
Well, let's remind ourselves, this was put out by the Mark Twain Project at the University of California, Berkeley, and it had to come out a century after his death by his own request. Why? What was that about?
Twain was actually, though he was a lover of invective and quite venomous when he needed to be, was actually a soft-hearted guy. And he knew that people were going to get hurt if he spoke totally forthrightly, you know, in his time. It was also, I mean, people say it was a great promotional trick or something, but I think it was really about sparing people's feelings.
And was that wise? Did you see things that maybe somebody might not have wanted to see in print?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let me read a passage that's about John D. Rockefeller Jr., who is the son of John D. Rockefeller, richest man in America, and also a sort of part-time religious commentator. Twain writes, "Young Rockefeller, who is perhaps 35 years old, is a plain, simple, earnest, sincere, honest, well-meaning, commonplace person, destitute of originality or any suggestion of it. And if he were traveling upon his mental merit instead of upon his father's money, his explanations of the Bible would fall silent and not be heard of by the public. But his father ranks as the richest man in the world, and this makes his son's theological gymnastics interesting and important. The world believes that the elder Rockefeller is worth $1 billion. He pays taxes on $2.5 million. Wow. Not only is he suggesting that John D. Rockefeller Jr. is a daddy's boy who doesn't have a lot upstairs, but also speaking incredibly bluntly about the plutocrats of that age. How would that square in today's political world?
Well, I was going to ask you, because some people have said, because of this style of dictation that you mentioned, it sort of feels a lot like blogging.
Well, saying that Twain is like a blogger is sort of like saying Picasso is like a graffiti artist. I mean, there's a question of genius, but there's also a question of cultural context here. People don't realize Twain was not only the most famous writer in the United States, he was one of the most famous people. He was a moral commentator, he was a performer in great demand. I mean, if you imagine taking John Updike and combining him with Jon Stewart and Oprah and Bruce Springsteen, you'd start to get an idea of the magnitude of Twain's power in the culture. There was no mass media, and Mark Twain was looked at as a guy who was the genuine article and somebody who was a real moral authority.
Well, he was born Samuel Langhorne Clemens. I've gotten that name wrong in the past, so I want to accent it. And we know in a story that we did on a book about hoaxes that in his early days as a reporter, he would just make things up because he'd get bored.
Yes.
So do we know that this is all true?
Well, that might be the central comparison that can be drawn with blogs. We do not know if it's true. The book, I should mention, is kind of ishkabibble would be the Yiddish word. It's kind of, a mishmash. It's not just a straight, I was born a young boy in Missouri. It's much more a compendium of rants and missives and some news dispatches. I was totally uninterested in the veracity, sort of the factual veracity. What we read Twain for his voice, for his moral perspective, his kind of cantankerous, wry, take-no-prisoners sensibility and sense of the world is why we read Twain.
Well, and you hear a lot of that in his description of a massacre in the Philippines.
Yeah, this is one of the most chilling and, I think, revelatory passages in the whole book. This is Twain responding to a telegram of congratulations involving this massacre of the Moros Indians in Philippines by the U.S. Army. His whole utterance is merely a convention. Not a word of what he said came out of his heart. He knew perfectly well that to pen 600 helpless and weaponless savages in a hole like rats in a trap and massacre them in detail during a stretch of a day and a half from a safe position on the heights above was no brilliant feat of arms and would not have been a brilliant feat of arms even if Christian America, represented by its salaried soldiers, had shot them down with Bibles and the Golden Rule instead of bullets. He knew perfectly well that our uniformed assassins had not upheld the honor of the American flag, but had done as they had been doing continuously for 8 years in the Philippines, that is to say, they had dishonored it.
Wow, assassins.
Uniformed assassins. Now, the amazing thing about Twain is he was, as he says, he was a red-hot imperialist for much of his early life. He came around to the idea that America was abusing its military advantage over other countries and being imperialist later on in life. So he was not some, you know, left-wing crazy. In fact, he was the opposite of that. He was a guy very much like Stewart or Colbert who targets hypocrisy and power, and he was continuously aiming for those throughout his career, whether in fiction or nonfiction.
That's literary critic Steve Almond on the new autobiography of Mark Twain. And we should say, too, that there's a huge sort of introduction before it starts, and then there's 400 or so pages or 300 pages of footnotes at the end.
It's like the opposite of a beach read,
whatever yes, it is.
That is.
It's a fall read.
That's right.
And tell us something you never heard before. Tell us something.
Well, I think one thing that comes through very clearly and quite beautifully is that he was a real devoted family man. Included in the book, and this is really charming, is the biography that one of his daughters, Susie, is writing about him, and he's quite taken with it. You can tell that underneath the cantankerousness and this incredibly sharp moral eye is a real father and husband who's very devoted to his family and has a real soft spot. And I should also mention that he's continuously in economic trouble.
Is he honest about that in the book?
Not only is he honest, but he is, to my mind, as a sort of writer who's struggling with some of the same things, he's enchantingly honest about his sense of grievance towards his publishers. He uses language that is untoward for the radio, and his relationships with these business partners, when the business goes south, he's really just very upfront about, like a lot of Americans can relate to right now, the guy was overextended.
That's literary critic Steve Almond. The guy he's speaking of is Mark Twain.
You know that guy, Twain.
The new autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, comes out November 15th. By the way, Steve is also author of a number of books of his own, including Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life. We'll have more about the new autobiography of Mark Twain at hereandnow.org. Steve, thanks.
Thank you.